And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome KJ Howe to the program today. KJ Howe is a resident of Toronto, Canada, and she's the executive director of the International Thriller Writers annual conference, Thriller Fest. In 2017, she made her debut as a thriller author with the first installment of a series starring Thea Paris, a consultant who helps free kidnap victims from around the world. The first book is called The Freedom Broker, and it's now available in paperback from Quercus. KJ, as The Freedom Broker opens, Thea Paris and her team from Quantum International are entering into Nigeria. What's the purpose of their mission?
Well, they're actually executing a hostage rescue. Now, in Thea's job as a response consultant, which is the industry term for kidnap negotiator.
And could there be a less specific title than that?
I know, right? I mean, response consultant, crisis response consultant, just doesn't have that sexy ring to it. That's why actually I coined the term freedom broker. And some of these response consultants are actually using the term freedom broker now, which is kind of flattering and fun. But they're on a rescue mission, and that's sort of a last resort because negotiations, the number one, you know, goal is to try and bring them home safely. During rescues, only about 20% of people come home safely. So it's very, very high stakes, and it's kind of a last-ditch effort as a way of saving a hostage. I wanted to open with something that showed that Thea, you know, had both tactical skills and, you know, leadership skills as well, because she's, you know, bringing a team in under the cover of darkness in Nigeria to try and extract a hostage. And I thought it would be a really, you know, kind of a exciting scene to start with.
Now, what are some of the differences between purely financial mercenary kidnappings and ones that are done with the political goal of, like, either getting a prisoner swap or money to fund their activities?
It's a great question. And kidnap for ransom has become really, really, like, it's exploding. And the sad part is because terrorists are turning to kidnap for ransom as a way of fundraising for their groups. And also, displaced military and police in developing countries are basically out of a job, have no way to put food on the table for their families. And so they're turning to kidnapping for a way of making a living. That area has really exploded. On the other side, people like ISIS with those really disturbing orange, you know, jumpsuit videos are doing things, you know, for political reasons. And they're really trying to highlight journalists in that because they really want media attention. And their whole goal is to create media attention and awareness about ISIS and Daesh and, you know, their goals. So I think it's a very interesting dichotomy, you know, between those two. Over the last few years when I'm in my research, I've become very good friends with Peter Moore, who is the longest held hostage in Iraq. And Peter was actually returned for a prisoner exchange, which worked out really well for him. And very sad because Peter was taken with five British military gentlemen, and Peter's the only one who survived and came home.
Who was holding him?
Well, basically, this is what happened. Peter, he's an IT expert, and he went on a contract 3 months to Iraq. And actually, in the first week of his work, if you can believe the luck of this, he was taken, and it was Iraqi militia. So basically what happened was he was there working, and all of a sudden there was a bit of noise outside, and he was teaching, you know, some of these programmers what they needed to do financial reports for the Iraqi government. And the gentleman came in with a gun and dressed in a police uniform, and he says, "Get down." And everyone just kind of was shocked, what's happening. So Peter was escorted outside, and there was over 100 policemen outside, and I guess they moonlight as an Iraqi militia. And so they grabbed him and the four gentlemen that were guarding him. You know, so in these countries, sometimes you can give someone a bribe and it's kind of like, let's just go away here.
A little bakshish.
Yeah, bakshish, exactly. But he tried that because he had a lot of cash on him. And they just threw the money out the window and then started asking him to undress and throwing his clothes out the window. And that's when he knew something was terribly wrong. And so the leader of the security team was thrown into the trunk after being beaten. Well, he was there for like 2.5 years. And for a while, he was held in captivity with the other security gentlemen. And he'd go back and forth from being with one group of two to the other group of two. And then he was kept alone. And after that, he found out that they had been killed.
Now, for purely ransom mercenary reasons, mm-hmm. I'm sure that wouldn't stretch out for that long. It seems like there'd be a much shorter time window to get a person back.
Well, believe it or not, it's to the advantage of the hostage to stretch out the negotiations. Your loved one's been taken. You're incredibly upset. You can't stand the thought of them being cold, alone, wet, you know, imprisoned. But the secret is that you have to be patient and you have to be able to negotiate and have your freedom broker or response consultant take their time with the negotiation process. The reason being is that if you capitulate and pay too much too soon, they will say, fine, that's a lovely down payment. Now I want this much and I'm keeping the hostage for now. So you have to cry poor. You have to make it sound like you're mortgaging your home and you're doing this, that, and everything to, you know, ask the local community to contribute donations so that you can try and pay the ransom. And it's a terrible strategy in a way because, you, like you said, you want it to close quickly. You want to get the hostage back home. But the best thing for them is to try and negotiate, because at the end of the day, if they are negotiating for ransom and for financial reasons, they want to, you know, basically have as much as possible. And so if they think there's more, they'll keep digging.
Now, we hear a lot about the financial kidnappings in Mexico and the rest of Latin America and Brazil. And it seems that kidnapping doesn't make headlines in America and Canada very often. I guess that's very conscientious that they try to keep it out of the news. But how big of a problem is it in the United States and Canada?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big issue more with human trafficking, actually, in the U.S. and Canada. But kidnapping isn't really a massive problem in North America. The reason being is this: 95% of kidnappers are caught and pay a very high price for kidnapping in the US and Canada. But in Mexico, you probably have a 95% chance of getting away with it because the federales and, you know, police and everything are, could even be involved in the kidnapping. So it's a very different setup. Prosecution is key for stopping kidnapping. That's why in North America, it's not the biggest issue. Sometimes it's domestic kidnaps, you know, with parents taking their child, things like that. But literally kidnap for ransom isn't huge in North America. On my website, kjhow.com, I have a map and it shows you the hot spots in the world. So just before you plan your next vacation, you might want to take a look at where it's, you know, popular. And so, you know, I think that with respect to prosecution, places like Mexico will only basically tamp down on kidnapping if they take it like a serious issue and start catching the people and punishing them, because it's too easy a way to make money.
And also, if the government actually had more weapons than cartels did.
The drug cartels are a massive problem for the kidnapping industry. Various cartels kidnap, you know, other people from the other cartels and set this up. And also, even locals, like very poor people, are being kidnapped and ransomed in Mexico now for $500. Just small amounts. And another thing that's really happening a lot is something called express kidnapping, where they'll take someone to their ATM and they'll kidnap them around 11:45 p.m. and keep them until 12:02, have them withdraw the full amount from the first day they kidnap them, then the next day, and then let them go.
So stay inside or near midnight.
Yes, exactly. It's not a great time to be out for a brief walk.
And did you happen to see the movie All the Money in the World?
Not yet, but I'm really excited about it because I've done some, you know, interesting research into that, you know, whole thing. So, yeah, I can't wait.
On this mission in Nigeria, one of Thea's team members, Riff Asker, goes off script during the mission. What does he do?
Ooh, are we going to do some spoilers here? It's fun.
Well, it's first chapter.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you. It's a lot of fun because I think Thea is in a man's world, okay? And I'm exploring this because she's a very capable individual, and yet a lot of freedom brokers are gentlemen. And so for her to be in charge and have this conflict, it's a lot of fun. And she's known Riff since she was a kid, and they have this kind of fun but combative relationship. Now, Riff is actually, Thea's basically watching from like a bird's eye view, you know, watching everything happen, while Riff's got the extraction team going in. And the intel was incorrect, and they couldn't find the hostage where they thought they were going to be. So Riff wants to keep searching little village there to see if he can find them. She says, please don't, because it's her job to protect her team and their lives. But he goes off script, as you said, and basically tries to search and find the hostage, and he does. But then, of course, the gentlemen who are guarding are aware of it, and then that's when the excitement starts.
And that can be really difficult when someone breaks an order and succeeds, because it really doesn't reinforce good team behavior.
I couldn't agree more. That's what was fun to write it, right? Because it was like if he failed, then it's like, you know, you should be disciplined for misbehaving and, you know, don't do that again. But you're right. And let's face it, they work in a world where they take chances every day.
Now, you mentioned that the world of hostage negotiation and kidnapping, freedom brokering is a gentleman-heavy field. Mm-hmm. So is the world of international thriller writers. Mm-hmm. So you and Thea seem to have a little bit in common there in dealing with kind of a more male-dominated area to work in.
Yeah, well, we have James Bond and Jason Bourne. Don't we need a little girl power in there? And that's what I love about Thea, you know. I wanted to make her very human, though, you know. I didn't want to create a superhero-type character. She's very capable, but when she fights men, because sometimes they're, you know, obviously bigger than her and stronger than her, I have her struggle. I have her use her mind to try and get out of things, you know, innovative or MacGyver things, because I think that's important. I don't want to create a character that is like a comic book. And that's why, you know, Thea has a lot of demons because of her dysfunctional family. And she also has an illness, type 1 diabetes. And that's part of the reason I gave her that, was to show that she has vulnerabilities and weaknesses, and that she is overcoming them to do what she loves and what her calling is.
How does she handle close quarter combat with having an insulin pump on her body?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can have a nice hard case to protect, and you can put the insulin pump. Sometimes they put it right here, like in the bra line. Sometimes, you know, you can put it on a belt. You definitely have to be careful. But also sometimes when Thea is going to be doing a mission, sometimes I take off the pump for her and she can use just regular syringes. I do that because some of these countries you visit and go to actually don't have proper insulin or not the same brand that's available. It's incredible if you do some research into diabetes, how traveling with it is tough because, you know, you may not have access to what you're used to, your different types of insulins. So I have her carry at all times syringes, which don't break down. They're very reliable, you know, so like insulin pens, things like that can malfunction. So I go with a very, very basic, syringe that she can use.
Well, it's nice to have a complicating factor in this world of cell phones and sat phones and mm-hmm. computer technology. You have to have something that kind of puts a spanner in the works.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, like diabetes, and especially the type 1, she needs insulin to survive. And there's always like a ticking time bomb. So it's built in incredibly good conflict inherent in every book because she needs to make sure she does that. And insulin needs to be kept at a certain temperature as well. So if you're in the desert in extreme heat, you have a cooling pack, but how long will that last for? And I'm hoping in each book, because it is a series, to explore different aspects of diabetes from a physiological standpoint, from a psychological standpoint, emotional. You know, just to really give insights into what someone with type 1 diabetes goes through.
Because it seems like you don't want to fall into the rut of just it being, I've got to get my shot at this time, that kind of repetitive danger that she's put in because of it.
100%. No, I'm going to be as innovative as possible.
Now, how did you become interested in kidnapping?
Well, growing up, I lived around the world. My father worked in telecommunications. So I lived in Africa, Saudi Arabia, Puerto Rico, Europe, you know, Austria and Switzerland, like all over the place. And I really loved the lifestyle. I was always a new kid and I was always a stranger in a strange land. And I think I felt, in a sense, there was a sort of overarching shadow. You know, you kind of had to worry about your safety, right? You're in a different place. You're not at home. And so that fascinated me. And a lot of crime fiction focuses on murder, but I find murder very final, right? It's done, and then you find out who did it. But kidnapping, for me, is a purgatory. You're alive, but you're not really living, and you're in this frozen bubble, and you don't know. You wake up every day knowing, is this going to be the day I'm set free, or is this going to be the day that I die? And I found that just fascinating, and that's why I wanted to explore it, because I saw it as kind of like hovering between living and dying, because you're not really living a great life when someone's telling you what to do 24/7, and you're stuck in horrific conditions. But you're not dead, you're still alive, and you still have hope. And I think that's what I wanted to explore. And in each book as well, I would love to take different viewpoints, you know, from the hostage's viewpoint, perhaps, and what they go through, for the negotiator's viewpoint and what they're trying to accomplish.
Now, how did Thea Paris become interested in kidnapping?
There's a personal story behind that. I think it was really important for this to be her calling more than just a job. And when she was 8 years old, she was living in Africa with her family, and her older brother, who was 12, Nikos, was kidnapped. You know, it's on the back cover, so it's not a spoiler. He was turned into a child soldier. And I think that experience, you know, he was taken in her place. She was actually the target. So she has a lot of what, you know, we'd call survivor's guilt in a sense, because she didn't have that horrible experience and her brother did. And her brother was never the same after he was kidnapped. So I feel like she saw the destruction that it it inflicted on her family. And she wanted to protect other families, you know, from having this happen and to bring more people back home.
And she has always loved and been devoted to her brother ever since then, while other people have not been able to hold on to that affection for Nikos.
Yeah. I mean, love is blind sometimes, right? I mean, I think that she has a very special connection with her brother. One of the main themes I wanted to explore in this book and all of my books, actually, is family. Because it's the thing that touches us the most. It's the most powerful love we feel, the most powerful frustrations we feel sometimes. And just because someone is part of your family, it doesn't necessarily mean that you get along with them as well. And there's a lot of conflict between Thea's father and brother. And she's kind of caught in the middle. So I wanted to explore some really dysfunctional family dynamics and had a lot of fun with that. And yeah, she sees the good side in Nikos because he truly does love her and he is very protective. And that night when he was taken, he was in her bedroom, you know, because she was crying and upset and scared. So I think she feels a lot of attachment to them from that, you know?
Now, the family name is Paris. Mm-hmm. Were you trying to recall classical myth and naming them that?
Well, actually, the whole reason I'm big into names, okay? Really big into names. I wanted to do a sort of a modern day Greek tragedy. I can't name my character, you know, Thea Thrombopoulos, you know, because it just doesn't ring off the thing. And also, I really thought it would be really neat to have an international name as well. Paris being, you know, kind of cutting edge that way. So that's sort of the reasoning behind Paris, was because it's actually a Greek name, a very popular Greek name, and also the other implications as well. So fun, right?
Yeah.
I want it to be multi-layered.
And of course, her father's name, Christos, is full of meaning too.
Absolutely. Exactly. And also, I don't know if you're familiar with the Greek tradition of name days.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I find that really interesting as well. Like, and I'm not Greek, you know, but I find the Greek culture and Greek food fantastic. And I really feel like, you know, with the name days, it's very special. You know, whenever your name is, it's sort of like, in a way, another birthday of sorts. And you get to celebrate your name day. And Christos, of course, is Christmas. I wanted to kick off the whole story with the father's name day celebration and then see what happened.
Now, is name day from christening or just when they finally get their name?
So if you're named Christos, that would be like your name day will always be Christmas. It does, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's actually attached to
the saint
the day.
Or something.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So if you were named Nicholas, it would be December 6th.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. That's how it works, right? You know, it's sort of attached to that.
Now, her father is very wealthy, a self-made man. What's his story? What is Christos' story?
Sure. Well, Christos was the son of a poor fisherman, and he grew up, and he was a very gritty guy, and he's very, like, industrious. So he did everything he could, you know, to learn about the oil industry from the ground up. We're talking, he started cleaning floors. He connected with another gentleman who had a company, but who was a bit of a playboy, and he didn't really want to work that hard. So Christos started taking over for him and working at the company, and he eventually ended up taking it over and renaming it Paris Industries.
It's also told in the blurb that you can find online at the booksellers that kidnapping comes to affect the Paris family again in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a lot of questions about that, and I love exploring it. So these people say, is kidnapping happen twice to a family? Is that likely? And the fact is, it is. It happens a lot out there in the real world. And the reason for that is why is because, let's say someone was kidnapped and they were, you know, successful, the kidnappers getting a solid ransom. That would make your family a lot more likely to be, you know, have either the same person kidnapped again, believe it or not, or to have another family member kidnapped because they know that is a source of cash that they can count on. It's a sad state to say that, you know, when you know a good target, you go for it maybe again and again. And there's a lot of like father-son things that happen. I find an interesting aspect of kidnapping that people can be kidnapped again or someone related to them can be.
Now, one of the services that Quantum International offers is training for corporate executives and employees around the world who might be kidnapped and how to deal with the kidnapping. So I guess Christos had been through this kidnapping training.
100%. Being, you know, a wealthy businessman, first of all, he would be a target. And also the fact that his daughter is a kidnap negotiator, I'm sure they had a bit of shop talk, you know, at home. It's a fascinating industry in the kidnapping world. They do a lot of mock kidnappings to give people a sense of what it would feel like. They take them through the steps. They blindfold them. They, you know, give them a bit of a beating, you know, nothing serious. But just to show them, dominate them with strong language and show that, because as soon as the kidnappers take you, They establish control through, you know, often a welcome beating or, you know, kind of really tough talking. They want to assert the fact that they are in charge and you are the hostage right away. So there's no kind of back talk.
Now, we also learned that in these training sessions, there was an executive who didn't take it very seriously. I wish we could have had another scene with him.
I would have loved to have done in a future book, I promise. Some people are very arrogant about the fact that, you know, they don't feel threatened or they don't want to take the proper precautions. And it's really Thea's job to educate and to protect them from themselves. And this gentleman in question, was, you know, absolutely had to go through it. But that's a story for another day, right?
Well, and with Christos being kidnapped, I mean, Thea's got to feel a lot of personal responsibility and probably professional failing because of this.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. Well, you know what they say, right? If a lawyer represents themselves in the case, they're a fool. Well, in this case, Thea has to come up against the thing that should she be, you know, handling her father's kidnapping because she's so personally involved. And the thing is, though, is that she knows so much more about him than anyone else. She's actually the best person to be researching and looking for information and trying to find him. And to negotiate because she's aware of what's going on. But yeah, it's a tricky, tricky situation because when you're negotiating for someone's, you know, freedom, sometimes you have to hang up on the kidnapper, you know? Sometimes you have to do things like play tough. And like I said earlier, you know, negotiate hard. You can't just capitulate. And it's a very difficult situation because they know that Christos has a lot of money, let's say, right? You know, he's a billionaire. So that aspect, there's no crying poor in that scenario. Yeah,
but how much is liquid and how much is readily available?
Exactly. And there's so many different factors that go into this. I mean, I've gotten to know several freedom brokers that do this. And there's only 25 people in the world that really do this full time. It's a very elite kind of area. And that's what fascinated me so much about, you know, creating a character with this kind of fresh job. Because, you know, she's private industry. Right. So there's no real rules, which is great. And she travels undercover to these foreign countries. And quite often these people will pose as marketing managers or English teachers when they go to the countries. And their job is basically to go in, negotiate, work it out and bring the hostage back out without, you know, involving local police if they can help it and making a ripple effect. You know, they want to do it subtly and quickly. And they also have to worry that they are a potential hostage, because we all know that kidnap negotiators have kidnap and ransom insurance. It's part of the job. So you want to be careful that you're not, you know, taken in that aspect.
Well, what's the challenge of writing about a career that is so relatively unknown, but also so very kind of narrow because it is such a small field? What are the challenges that you've had in investigating that and representing it in your writing?
Well, the beautiful thing is that, you know, I was very, very lucky to have people in this industry who trusted me enough to talk openly. I did all my research, like I read everything I could get my hands on about kidnapping. And then I decided, no, this isn't enough. I really need to meet people who do this. So believe it or not, I Googled Kidnap and Ransom Conference, and there is such a thing. And I attended it. I have to say, I didn't know what the reception would be. And I think the fact that I'm not a journalist, right? I'm not trying to write about the case they're working on or get inside scoop on anything. But I just really wanted to learn about what they did so I could represent it in true light. And they were very open and kind with sharing stories. You know, I spent a lot of time chatting with them just about war stories, you know, what they've gone through to get a sense of what's involved. And you need a lot of attributes to be a freedom broker, like patience. You usually have to speak at least another language because you can't really communicate through a translator unless you totally trust that translator. And also you'd be careful because there's a lot of nuances that if you understand the language fluently, you can pick up on. But if you don't, you might miss it. So that was a key thing too. So being able to have access to, like, I became very good friends with Peter Moore, the longest held hostage in Iraq. I got to hear how he survived, you know, his 2.5 years in captivity. So I feel like I've been extremely lucky to have those insights, which allows me. The challenge is, without going through it yourself, you really, really don't know exactly how you'd feel. So you have to sort of extrapolate and try to write the best you can. The good news from a series perspective is that there are so many different types of kidnapping There's tiger kidnapping, which is where, let's say, someone worked at a pharma company and they had a formula or a drug that was really in demand and worth a lot of money. Someone might kidnap the wife and kids of that pharma executive and extort the formula from them. And that's called tiger kidnapping because you're basically, you know, using someone in their family to get them to do something, not ransom, but get something else. You know, there's the express kidnapping we talked about earlier where, you know, it's like really quick in and out, making a quick dollar. You know, there's the political aspects and prisoner exchange kidnappings. And there's, of course, terrorism, you know, which is a huge issue in our world today. And how, you know, a lot of people are being kidnapped and used for propaganda purposes. So it's just a fascinating area. And I feel like there are countless locations that Thea can go to for the books, and there are countless different types of kidnappings. For example, in a future book, I'm going to do a story about Thea's first kidnap case, how she cut her teeth on it, what happened, how she did. And I'm also going to do one where a kidnap negotiator goes rogue and takes somebody, and she has to play cat and mouse against someone who's taught her everything she knows because it's her mentor that is, you know, basically behind the scenes. So I just feel like there's so much potential there. And, you know, the narrowness of it, I think, is fascinating, which makes it different. You know, there's a lot of stories out there about FBI agents. There's a lot of stories about, you know, police detectives. But freedom brokers or response consultants, you know, aren't really. So I'm hoping to do something just a little different.
Well, as a person who runs Thrillerfest, when you went to their conference, were you able to turn off your conference runner mind and just experience the conference? Or are you going, well, they should have done this differently?
That's a really good question. They did a terrific job, actually. They were immaculately, I was like taking notes. Like they taught me stuff. No, it is hard to go to conferences and not know about all the behind the scenes stuff that goes on, because I've been running Thrillerfest for about 9 years now. And it's such a joy. There's about 1,000 people who come every year to New York City at the Grand Hyatt. And some of the top thriller authors from all over the world, you know, join us. Like, you know, R.L. Stine of Goosebumps fame comes every year. Lee Child, Jack Reacher comes every year. This year we have a very special guest in George R.R. Martin from Game of Thrones. It's such a great group of people. If you ever have a chance to come, please do, because it's fun, friendly. Everyone chats in the hallway. We have cocktail parties every evening. We have a big banquet with awards, you know, so that the Thriller Master, which is the Lifetime Achievement Award, can be presented. And we also have like best novel and best ebook every year. So it's a great, great week. I'm very lucky because I can connect with the FBI, the CIA, the ATF, the Secret Service, the U.S. Marshals, and they all come and talk as well to educate the writers on, you know, exactly what's going on. It's really quite fun sometimes on my answering machine, if, you know, it says, hey, it's, you know, Bob from the Secret Service calling, you know, and I swear I'm not in trouble. It's just setting a session up for Thrillerfest.
I wonder how many thriller writers have viewed the political happenings of the past year and gone, I could not have come up with this.
Probably not. It's rather creative. And being a Canadian, it's been fascinating to watch.
Are y'all afraid?
Always. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, whatever happens in the U.S. has a tremendous impact on Canada as well as the rest of the world. So, yeah, absolutely. We're fascinated, too. Your politics are way more exciting than ours. We tend to have very, like, low-key, you know. Everyone says our prime minister is handsome.
Well, I mean, Stephen Harper was kind of a difficult person to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, your mayor in Toronto was a handful
and a
half.
Oh, good heavens, yes.
He was kind of a proto-Trump.
A lot of people would come up to me and say, oh, you're from Toronto. How about your mayor? You know, when that definitely was an issue.
Now, there's a few more characters we should probably touch on
sure.
in the interview. And of course, one is the shadowy arms dealer Ares. What do the international intelligence community know about this very unknown figure?
Have you seen Lord of War?
Yes.
Okay, because I love that movie. It fascinated me. And for some reason, I think my international travel, I love intrigue and, you know, and like I just find arms dealers really interesting. So I decided to create a character that was an arms dealer and that lived, you know, kind of a dual life. And it's a very dangerous, I actually know an arms dealer. You know, it's a very interesting world. They're constantly meeting with people behind the scenes in different countries, you know, coups, right? And but they also deal with people like the CIA. And I just find that very interesting how it's big money, big business weapons. And I also find it very interesting to see where weapons are made and where they're shipped from. And, you know, a lot of like old Soviet Union, you know, kind of weapons, AK-47s are like some of the best weapons out there, the most reliable rifle. Like a lot of the special forces guys I talk to who are experts for my book, they all love the AK-47. And it's really interesting to see, you know, where things are manufactured, where they end up. Yeah. So I think arms dealing is a fascinating world that I'd like to explore.
And then also an American government operative named Gabrielle Ferra becomes involved. What's the American government interest in all this?
I really wanted to bring authenticity to the book. So there is a group called the Hostage Recovery Fusion Cell. This whole group was spearheaded by the FBI, but it's a multi-agency unit. And it's actually real in real life. Just in the last, like Obama, just before he finished his in office, created this because there was so much flack from journalists like James Foley and Stephen Sadloff and the way their families were handled that it was obvious the right hand and the left hand didn't know what they were doing. So they wanted to create an agency. And it's really wonderful because communications improved greatly. I've had the pleasure of meeting people who are involved in this agency. And they work with the hostages' family of Americans kidnapped abroad and make sure that they're informed and they know everything that's happening. And it's a tricky situation because the US, Canada, UK, they all say they'll never negotiate with terrorists. And there was like a directive in the US for the longest time that it was actually illegal for families to pay ransoms for the return of their loved ones. Now, no one's ever prosecuted for that, of course, because it'd be a media outrage over it. But there was a law. These days, it's a little bit looser because I think that they feel if they're going to get some intelligence based on, you know, terrorism, things like that, they're kind of willing to let it go. But it's always the families who have to pay the ransom, never the government, because you never want to encourage kidnapping to happen over and over again, right? And that's the problem, is that when it's your loved one who's out there, you're willing to pay anything to get them back. But as a country, you can't keep paying because then you become more likely to be kidnapped. There are certain countries out there, this is what I find really fascinating. There are certain countries that tend to pay more and quicker, like Italians and Japanese. They tend to pay a lot more money, a lot faster. So it depends on, like, if you're taken in a group kidnapping situation and you're among other hostages from different nationalities, it can profoundly affect your fate, what nationality you are.
Because if you're there with the Italians and Japanese, they say, why aren't your people paying
exactly.
as much and as quickly?
You know, and you want to hear a really interesting fact. Israelis, they tend to pay promptly and a fair amount. But after they get their person back, they hunt the kidnappers down and kill them. So that is their literal process.
No,
so
it's like a Mossad thing that they.
I think that would probably curtail some kidnappers from picking up Israelis because if they know that they're going to be targeted for death, they're less likely probably to take those people. So maybe that's working.
The fictional country of Kanzi in Africa comes to be a big part of the story. Is that like a stand-in for Botswana or?
Well, okay. So I lived in Kenya growing up and for 3 years. I love Africa. It's one of my favorite places on this earth. I think it's the most magnificent, beautiful place. The animals are incredible. Sadly, a lot of strife, you know, Zimbabwe, you know, with Mugabe has been a huge mess. And I love Botswana, by the way. And Botswana is actually one of the most successful African country. They have very good economy and really good game viewing. I didn't want to like name a country because I wanted to mix together different aspects of different African countries. And I also felt like I didn't want to slam any African country because I love them so much too. So it was kind of just a fun way of kind of picking and choosing different aspects of different African countries and combining them into one country.
What's the status of down there with Mugabe being out of power?
Well, I have some friends who live in there. I think it's good and hopefully like, you know, but it's also chaotic. Like, that's the problem with African politics these days, right? Is that you never know who's going to take over. You never know what's going to happen when someone... When I was in Africa, you know, my father worked and he was in charge of Uganda, Tanzania, and Kenya. You know, Idi Amin at that point was, you know, still reigning. It's amazing how powerful and influential people can be. Like, these leaders are incredibly difficult. But then what happens is when they're gone, sometimes there's a vacuum. And you're not sure who's going to take over that. You never say it can't be worse, right?
That's
the
right,
because it can always be worse. So you don't know. And I feel bad because I think Africa is absolutely full of incredible resources, natural resources. And China is buying up quite a bit of them. It's a really interesting thing that's happening across the continent. They have a lot of money they're infusing into the countries, and I think that's going to have a profound influence on the future of Africa as well.
Have you seen the BBC documentary All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace by Adam Curtis?
No, I have to check it out.
It talks about Ayn Randian philosophy, mm-hmm. especially being big in the technology community, and how that's led to so much strife in Central Africa because of the mining for the trace minerals and materials that are needed to manufacture electronics. Because that's why the Chinese are expanding into Africa, is because they need the raw materials to keep their electronics manufacturing going. And that's why they've invested so much money in Australia as well.
Yeah, very well said. Exactly. And it's really, and oil as well. They're investing a lot of in a lot of places for oil.
Because oil is a big play in the story.
Of course. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like that's what I love about international thrillers, is that you can really like focus on the geopolitical issues in the world, which I find fascinating, you know, because you can see different countries, how they work, how they live. You know, I find that like very intriguing. And I hope anyway that when people read The Freedom Broker, Skyjack, they'll feel when they put the book down that they've learned of something, you know, because I feel like that's what I love doing. When I read a fictional book, I also feel like I want to grow as a person and kind of learn a few facts.
Now, as you mentioned, the next book in the series, Skyjack, comes out in April 2018. What is Thea and her crew going to be dealing with in this story?
Okay. This one's fun. So Thea is taking two African child soldiers. They were in an orphanage, to their new home in London. And they're headed from Nairobi to London when the plane they're on is skyjacked. I don't know if you are familiar with, but I found this really fascinating because I'm always looking for, you know, kind of unique things that are in the past. After World War II in Europe, there was a band of secret armies in different countries that were there, and they were working with the CIA and, you know, MI6 as a way of protecting against communism. And in Italy, this group was called the Gladio.
So they went up against the Red Brigade?
Yeah, like, I mean, exactly. And they had caches of weapons, okay, and soldiers ready to go. And a lot of people are not even aware that these organizations existed. And there's proof that even as of 2006, they were still in operation. Interesting, right? So I took that and ran with it and have them being very active currently. But the threat is not necessarily communism anymore, but something else. And so that's what I had fun with. So it's secret armies, and we've got the Vatican, the CIA involved, and a lot of other things. So I'm hoping that people will enjoy it and learn a little bit about the history of these secret armies.
And maybe a little bit of Radon and Tebby as well.
Hey, oh yes, definitely. Wasn't that the best? Oh my gosh. Have you seen documentaries on that?
They did like a TV movie of it back in the late 70s, and I remember seeing that when I was young.
That was one of the most effective operations ever. And wasn't that brilliant how they, you know, basically like disguised themselves as Idi Amin Mercedes coming in, you know, to try and save the hostages. I was very inspired by that story, definitely, for Skyjack. But I did some definitely, like, you know, interesting twists on it. And I hope people will enjoy. I've done extensive research on planes for Skyjack, so hopefully you'll learn a little bit. And the one tip I can say is that the safest place on a plane is actually the rear, and followed by the middle over the wings. And those people in first class who paid extra for that ticket, well, not as safe.
Well, at least they die soon and don't have to deal with them trying to survive. So with running Thriller Fest over the years, and now that you're a published thriller author going to festivals and conferences, do you have a little bit more sympathy toward the writer's experience at your festival?
What I try and do is to make everyone feel like a rock star, because they are. You know, I want everyone to come and to feel special and to have a great time. I think it's very exciting to come to a conference because as writers, we spend a whole lot of time alone, you know, writing up a storm and in isolation. And to come together with people who fully understand, you know, our eccentricities and, you know, what we love thinking about. Like, I laugh so hard because, like, quite often I'm on the phone with, like, a SWAT friend, you know, talking about how do I blow this up, you know? And some people might think that's a little odd. But to me, I'm so passionate about thrillers and that world. And so if we come together and spend time with people who feel the same way about all this world, you know, I think it's really, really inspirational and fun. So in what way do you mean, like, kind of feel for them? Do you mean that?
Well, just that it's a different experience than what you've had as a person who runs a convention,
yeah,
as opposed to being an attendee and having a different set of pressures and expectations on you.
Yeah, I feel very relaxed when I go to conferences because I don't have to run them. It's hard because you're always like, You know, you have to be like a duck when you're the conference organizer, you know, calm on the surface and paddling like heck underneath the surface.
Well, KJ, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, real pleasure. Thanks for the wonderful questions. They're really insightful.
KJ Howe is the author of The Freedom Broker, which is the first installment of the Thea Paris series, which is new in paperback from Quercus. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.